Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival. James Corbett is Frank, the producer, hasn't told me if James is or is not here.
I'm here.
All right. I'm going to operate on the presumption that you are. James is the author of the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com, for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. James is a regular guest on the program, and I always look forward to it. It's fun talking to James. You know, interesting ideas, interesting perspective. And here's one from the Chinese, China Daily Mail. Publication coming out of China. It says, Chinese media says India's economy will surpass China's. It's an interesting article. Doesn't mean it's true, but milhongqing.com, Chinese publication apparently, says in its report today that according to the Indian publication, The Hindus, report of April 29th, India is expected to achieve a growth rate of 8% faster than China. Not exactly a coherent sentence, but you get the idea. They are predicting that India is going to grow faster than China. If it conducts further reform and achieves steady growth rate, it will certainly surpass China's economy. China is not afraid of India surpassing it, even though it has had border disputes with India. Xi Jinping has even provided India with financial assistance, and they say only the United States is afraid of another country surpassing it and even willing to harm itself, to harm China, the Chinese report stated. So what do you think about that? Is India, does it have a chance that it's going to surpass the Chinese economy? Is that even rational?
Well, there's a trick to this. It's not that it's going to surpass the Chinese economy. It's going to surpass the Chinese economy's growth rate, or at least predicted to. So once, I mean, there's a few different layers to this, one of which is this is based on predictions and crystal balling, which we all know how accurate these types of forecasts can be, and how meaningful they even are. As we've talked many times before, the Chinese GDP figures that they give out and the growth rates are more or less cooked numbers that are pretty much drawn out of a hat. So they don't give anything resembling an accurate estimate of the actual growth rate of the Chinese economy, other than generally speaking, I mean, we can gauge whether the economy is growing faster or slower based on these types of rates, but we don't get a very accurate picture anyway. So keep that level of obfuscation in mind. Plus the fact that India has been predicted for many years, it should be growing at a pace similar to what China was growing at. It should be doing this. It should be doing that. It hasn't yet. In fact, we saw that Indian ruble fiasco a year or two ago where we saw a huge tumble in the ruble. The rupee. We saw a huge tumble in the value of the rupee about a year and a half ago as the Federal Reserve started to ease back on its quantitative easing program. So we know there are inherent structural instabilities in India, the Indian economy. So take these predictions for what they're worth. But even, again, on top of that, this is an expected to grow faster, faster growth rate, not an actual size of the Indian economy versus the Chinese economy. Just to put that in perspective, according to IMF data in 2014, China's economic output was over $10 trillion last year. India's about $2 trillion. So even if it is a faster growth,
a long way to go. Yeah, there is no comparison at this time. There's no. What is the relationship between China and India? And what I mean by that is this. China, people sit in the United States, and to some degree, they distrust China. They say, oh my gosh, China might attack the United States, or they might do this, or they might do that. Some people are concerned about them. Is China more concerned with Japan than the United States? Or is China more concerned with India than the United States or Japan? Where does China see, you know, they have people in China who are paranoid in the same sense we have people in the United States and Japan who are paranoid. Where do you think China, on average, sees its greatest threats and adversaries?
Well, speaking for the Chinese people, I mean, obviously that's a pretty huge question that I would feel uncomfortable answering for a lot of different reasons, mostly because I've only visited China. I've never actually lived there, let alone I'm not Chinese myself. But I think one of the things we'd have to take into account with this question is that China is a very large country with a very diverse population. So I think there are different sectors and different geographical sections and different ethnic and religious factions that would view the Chinese-Indian relationship differently than the Chinese-Japanese relationship. So I don't think it's a monogamous? No, you know what I mean. I don't think there's monolithic. It's not one view that all Chinese would have. If we're talking diplomatically, then the Beijing sort of central viewpoint. Well, we know, for example, that in June 2012, China officially stated that the Sino-Indian ties could be its most important bilateral partnership of the century, which could just be kind of flowery diplomatic rhetoric, but they have actually set a goal to increase bilateral trade between the two countries to $100 billion by this year. So that's up from $73.9 billion in 2012. So I don't know if they will find out, I guess, if they make it to the $100 billion mark. But still, I mean, it's a growing and important tie. And we see that formalized in institutions like the BRICS. So whatever disputes they have had in the past, and they certainly did, of course, they did have the Sino-Indian War and some of the border skirmishes there in the 60s. So there is some bad blood there. But obviously that's being overcome, if for nothing else than economic necessity. Meanwhile, obviously the China-Japanese tensions are continuing to flare up, continuing to be quite raw, and continue to hit, I think, a nerve genuinely with a lot of the nationalists on both sides of that coin, in a way that I don't imagine plays into the popular imagination of the Chinese with the Sino-Indian War. So I think that it is, if there is a boogeyman in Chinese politics, it would be more likely to be Japan than India. But it's not to say that India and China are best buddies unproblematically, but I think they've been thrown into a relationship where they're kind of smoothing over some of the bumps.
To what extent do you think China is willing to engage in military adventurism, and to what extent do you suppose they are more interested in becoming a dominant commercial nation?
My sense is that China's model for world domination, I don't know if that's quite the right way to put it, but I think their model for the future of China and its growth anyway is an economic one primarily. I don't think that they're interested in or would benefit from a military conquest in the way that Pax Americana has spread the American empire around the world over the past century. So I think just in their own interests, if nothing else, I think the economic model serves their benefits. And there's ideas and memes going around that you know, the Chinese aren't militarily aggressive and they've never aggressed against other nations and blah, blah, blah. That's not exactly true. I mean, they've certainly had their share of border skirmishes, for example, with India. There's obviously Tibet and what happened there. So China is not, I think, blameless or spotless on the international stage, but nevertheless, they're clearly not as militarily aggressive as the NATO powers, and I don't think that's in their game plan. So I think really it is the sort of economic model that's more their model for expanding their influence around the globe.
China's made attempts to control its birth rate over the last perhaps 40 years. I'm not sure how far you can trace that back, maybe further than that. Have they succeeded in getting their birth rate under control to where they can tolerate how many people they have? Or are the demographics growing, population growing at a rate that's likely to push them into some sort of military adventurism?
Certainly growth is not the problem in China at this point. In fact, there is kind of a demographic crunch that's occurring now, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I know we've just passed over a certain hurdle or a certain milestone, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's something to do with the fact that now we have just seen the greatest greatest birth rate in that's expected in the Chinese demographic growth rate, and now the birth rate is declining to the point where we're going to see a population decline in the future as a result of this. So we're sort of over a demographic bump, which is interesting because that will start to play out in terms of even the Chinese housing markets and things along those lines. And people have been talking about that for at least a couple of years now. So there are some, clearly the Chinese government has been effective in its aim of attempting to curb the birth rate. And I think that's just one aspect of its overall attempt to control every aspect of Chinese society and completely regiment the life of Chinese citizens. One of the most disturbing stories in that general trend that I saw recently was one that I saw coming out of De Volkskrant, out of the Netherlands. They had this article, China Rates Its Own Citizens, Including Online Behavior, talking about how the Chinese government is currently implementing a nationwide electronic system called the Social Credit System, attributing to each of its 1.3 billion citizens a score for his or her behavior. The system will be based on various criteria ranging from financial credibility and criminal record to social media behavior. From 2020 onwards, each adult citizen should, besides his identity card, have such a credit code. So that, I mean, just the scale and scope of managing a database of 1.3 billion citizens and tracking what they're doing, not only financially, but also online, and compiling, because of course you do have to register to get online in China, and to compile all of that information into some sort of system that's going to be tracking you and giving you a number rating score. Just that type of bureaucracy alone is mind-boggling, let alone what it implies about the mindset of the Chinese leadership.
How soon do you suppose the CIA and NSA will impose a similar system here in the United States? Hmm.
As soon as they can, I would venture to say. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a chilling idea. It's the sort of thing where if you have a low score in China, that will open the doors for abuse. People can treat you with contempt if you're down at the bottom. You will be something like the untouchables, or to some degree in this country, if you had a low score, it would be similar to being black in this country. It's just wrong, and yet you look at it and you wonder if it can be resisted. Can the forces of technology be suppressed in favor of liberty, or are they just necessarily going to triumph until we see some sort of collapse or revolution? What do you think?
I think technology is a neutral tool. It depends on who's wielding that tool and for what purposes. And I think the same technology that enables that type of mind-boggling bureaucracy of tracking 1.3 billion people and keeping them in databases and giving them numbers, scores for how, you know, good a citizen they are, is the same technology that we could be using to start interacting with each other through a peer-to-peer economy, decentralized, without the need for central banks and all of this. We could imagine the same technology being used in very freeing ways to really allow, for the first time in human history, all human beings to interact freely with each other anywhere on the globe. What an amazing thing that would be. But of course, that depends on people actually wielding and using that technology for what it should be for, rather than going online and going to Google and YouTube and Facebook and the handful of other sites that we know have been nested in with the U.S. intelligence complex from the very beginning. And well, that's not likely to happen anytime soon, unfortunately.
It also depends on governments allowing it to happen. For example, the technology that we are concerned about China using on its own people, you know, in theory, the people could use that among themselves in a beneficial way. But would the government of China tolerate using the Chinese people using that technology without reference to the government? Would the government of the United States tolerate a similar technology being used among private people in this country, or would they work to stomp it out?
Well, that is not a rhetorical question. That's a very real question that we're seeing answered in a lot of ways right now, including a story that just came out that I think is really important. It's an ongoing story, but Wired just had an article out, 3D printed gun lawsuit starts the war between arms control and free speech. This surrounds Cody Wilson and his Defense Distributed company, which created the first 3D printable gun. It's not all of the components for a gun, but it's the essential components to create a gun with a 3D printer. And they were they had the electronic design blueprints for that on their website, downloadable in 2013. They received a cease and desist from the Directorate of Defense Trade Controls, which told them that they couldn't distribute that under the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, ITAR, which forbids basically the export of weapons. So essentially, the U.S. government is making the argument that these design blueprints for a gun, which can be then downloaded and used to print out something on a 3D printer locally, those blueprints are essentially the exact same as exporting an actual gun. And the question, fundamentally, the question that the courts now are going to decide is, does the, is free speech, does that cover the blueprints for the gun? Is that a form of speech, or is that an actual gun itself? And that is going to have a huge, huge impact on the future of this technology and all sorts of implications for this technology, not just in terms of 3D printed guns, but 3D printed anything. Can you have the design blueprints and for all sorts of objects and send them freely around the world, or can the government intervene between you and it and say you can't have the speech, free speech to use those blueprints for what you want?
It should be an interesting court case and an interesting decision. Because the Supreme Court has previously ruled that money is a form of free speech, political campaign contributions. We can give cash to people, essentially, at least checks, and that's free speech. How could it be? How are they going to be able to juggle a comparison between, how about I give them a plan to make a firearm? How can that not be free speech if giving money to to politicians is free speech? And we'll look at that, and we'll look at an answer to that question when we return. We're going to take some commercials, and James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com and myself will return on Financial Survival in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Folks, I'm Alfred Adask on Financial Survival. I'm here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. And we were talking about a prospective Supreme Court decision that'll decide whether free speech includes the right to disseminate plans to make weapons, or if it does not. And comparing it to free speech here in this country, as Supreme Court has declared, it includes the right to give money, or at least checks, to political campaign or politicians. You can contribute that as political campaign contributions, and it's deemed to be a form of free speech. So what is the probability that we're going to see the Supreme Court rule against the idea that Cody Wilson can disseminate plans to make 3D printed guns?
Well, unfortunately, the political climate of the United States being what it is, I would be surprised if they do ultimately rule in Cody Wilson's favor. I'm going to assume that they're going to try to crack down on this technology, and would be delighted if this turns out otherwise, but will not be surprised if it turns out in favor of the people who want to crack down on this. Not necessarily even about this issue in particular. There are things to be talked about with regards to this, but I think that the underlying issue is the freedom of speech to distribute the blueprints, the design blueprints, especially when it's not even a copyright issue or anything. It's blueprints that you've created yourself, the ability to distribute that. Because again, this can be, once that precedent is set, of course, it can be applied to everything. It's not going to just be about printed guns. It's going to be about anything that the government deems as a threat to public safety. So I think this is an important issue. I think the Supreme Court, if it lands at that level, is ultimately going to come down on the wrong side. But, you know, we remain to be seen on that. But perhaps more importantly than that is the fact that given the technology itself, it may not really matter what side the government comes down on, because it's going to be much, much, much harder to put the lid back on this bottle or put the toothpaste back into this tube than in previous eras, because the technology itself is designed around basically getting out there, getting the information out there quickly and in a decentralized way, in a way that's difficult to control. And there's something online that's called the Streisand effect that this Wired article actually goes into, which is basically the idea when you try to censor something on the internet, it becomes much more popular. And an exact example of this is the fact that
the example is going to be, or at least I suspect I do. Go ahead.
Well, within 2 days of the State Department having tried to invoke this IDAR against Defense Distributed, 100,000 downloads of that blueprint for that 3D printed gun were downloaded again in just 2 days after that decision was made. So they can try to put the lid.
Obama.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Obama trying to restrict, trying to impose gun control, and every time he does, they sell a
exactly.
Few firearms,
exactly. So really, I mean, the genie's already out of the bottle on this one. They can put some legal framework in place for it, but the technology is already there for this to be distributed, and it already is distributed among at least hundreds of thousands of people at this point. And I think once it's that widely distributed, that knowledge is not going to be completely deleted from the face of the planet.
I understand. This kind of leads into another article we have here from KC Research. And it's governments around the world outlawing cash. This is an idea that's kind of jumped up just in the last 2 weeks or so, where all of a sudden we see evidence and reports on the internet that the governments of the world, they're trying to get rid of cash. I'm wondering, we'll get into this article in a moment, but given that the Supreme Court has declared that political campaign contributions are a form of free speech, can the United States get rid of cash without violating our freedom of speech rights?
They certainly say that they can. so yes, well, they're trying it at any rate. And I don't know if the Casey Research article you're looking at is regarding the Louisiana case and House Bill 195.
Not that I know. I have it in front of me. I don't have all of. I think this is just looking. They reference it, Italy, Spain, Denmark, Israel, Mexico, Uruguay. They are all imposing restrictions on using cash.
Yes.
The U.S. has a suspicious activity report. They're concerned about that. They start out talking about France is trying to restrict access to cash in order to fight terrorism, which is just a bunch of crap.
Right.
Everyone understands that, and yet we do see. Well, are we seeing evidence? Is this a big thing that's capturing the globe right now? Or is this, you know, it rained in France the other day and it rained in Spain, it rained in Italy. It's not really a New World Order objective per se.
I think it is.
You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Is this intentional that we're seeing it all over? Is this intentional or is it just a certain randomness to it?
Well, I think it is a New World Order objective, but I think, I mean, there are practical reasons that are always given, and they make more or less degrees of sense in various ways. It's just that when you lose sight of the bigger picture of what comes into play when you have a completely cashless society, and it's not cash per se, it's just the idea of some sort of physical object that can actually be traded. If you take that out of the economy, what are you left with? You are only left with, it's certainly in our economies that are dictated by central banks and their phony fiat money laws that create these currencies that have to be accepted for payments, what all you're left with is the digital equivalents of that float around online. So, I mean, there's a lot of implications to this, but one of the interesting ones is that if you are successful in eliminating cash from a society, or at least mostly so, you can't really have bank runs anymore. Because all you have, I mean, bank runs are when people come to try to physically take the money out of their bank accounts to physically get something that they can hold in their hands, and the bank can't physically provide it all, so they go under. Well, you can't have that in a system where it's all digital credits, because that can be manipulated behind the scenes. It can also be an economy that is completely manipulable by the government. For example, if the government decides you owe X amount of, you know, back taxes because of whatever arbitrary law they just passed, they can suddenly go into your accounts and take them out directly without having, you know, you having a bunch of paper dollars stashed under your mattress. They know exactly what you have, where you have it, and they can manipulate it any way they want. That it becomes technologically possible in such a society. So I think the bonuses of that for the would-be controllers is obvious. I think some of the only stops to that is the fact that things like the drug trade and other things that governments and intelligence agencies really do use to fund their operations, like Iran-Contra and things like that, very much rely on cash. So I think if there's any bulwark against that, it's things like that. But no, we do see this agenda playing out in a lot of countries right now. And I think it is a lot of hogwash and baloney that they're throwing at us, and they're just basically trying to make us feel that cash is just so outdated, so so second millennium, man. Get with the third millennium. We're already in it.
I understand. I wonder what they're going to do. If we're going to have a cashless society and everyone's going to have to use a number, what are they going to do with homeless people? What are they going to do with illegal aliens? Can they tell the American people, look, we're going to give up. Everybody comes across the border. There'll be somebody there at the border to hand you your own little debit card that you can use, the illegal aliens. What do they do with these people?
Well, again, this makes...
And how do they justify giving money to illegals or even the homeless? How do they justify
that? Right. Well, this makes every aspect of human society controllable in ways that were unthinkable before. I mean, you couldn't even have undocumented illegal immigrant workers working under the table or anything of that sort, because, again, all you would have is these credits that could be tracked in one way or another. There would be people spoofing and creating fake identities and whatever, but that would be a much more limited phenomenon than it is now. So the question... is ultimately one of complete control of the government, which then could arbitrarily decide, okay, well, we've just decided, to grant complete amnesty to everyone and boom, turn on these special cards. They'll get special worker permit cards so that they get, credits that can only be transferred back to their home country or blah, blah, blah. Well, however, whatever kind of system they come up with, but suddenly it's by decree, just by decree, you can pretty much flip a switch and you can create a whole new system. And same thing with homeless. I mean, we've seen over the last few years, they've been trying out in various places in Florida and other places to try to ban feeding the homeless and ridiculous ideas like this. And imagine if laws like that are combined with a system where we already see food credits, food stamps are now going to the electronic variety. So people just have these cards that they use and that get topped up by the government electronically. Well, imagine that system coming together in a way that completely controls what can or cannot filter down to the homeless level. You can literally outlaw homelessness in the sense that if you are homeless, well, you're just going to starve to death. I mean, it is the mark of the beast system. Whatever you think of biblical prophecy, it really is that system where you can be completely turned off and have your card deactivated or whatever and have no access to the economy. And that is the ultimate nightmare of this.
I've got another article here from World Politics Journal, and the headline is "The Bank of Japan Needs More Time to Reach Its 2% Inflation Target." Does that mean that Abenomics is failing? Or do they need more time? Or are they admitting this thing is not working?
Did it ever work at all? No.
And that was my question. Even with quantitative easing in the United States, I'm not convinced that that worked. I would say I'd give it credit for stopping a complete crash in this country, but it certainly hasn't restarted the economy to a significant degree.
Or at least pausing the complete crash.
Anybody running this thing? Is the system capable of being controlled right now?
You know, that's an interesting question.
Does anyone really have any control, or do they just have offices?
That's an interesting question. Yeah. Because I think that maybe gets to the point of this. There was an interesting quote from one of the Fed board members a year or two ago, and I'm not going to be able to pull it up while we're talking here, but the quote was something along the lines of, basically, not even the Fed really knows or understands how quantitative easing should work. Even insiders admit that they don't really know what's going on or how this is all going to play out. But I mean, I think you're right. In the Bank of Japan example specifically, we see the laughability of a statement like that. They have created an unbelievable amount of money. I believe they've added something like 25% of the GDP of the country to the money supply in the past couple of years and still can't even get inflation to the 2% target. The idea that just doing more, if something works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do more of it too, is basically the bankster's mantra at this point. It's all they've got. You're exactly right. Yep. There's nothing they can do other than just keep printing till the cows come home or until the crash happens. So I think we have to look at a similar situation in the U.S. And now, again, you're getting all sorts of insiders saying that the crash is inevitable. Bill Gross's recent investment outlook for his new outfit. He, of course, left PIMCO last year. He's now with Janus Capital. And, of course, their logo is Janus, the two-faced god. So take of that what you will. I don't know. Interesting symbology. But his most recent investment outlook, very interesting. It's called
Truth in Advertising.
Yeah, I think so. But his latest investment outlook is called A Sense of an Ending. And it's basically all about how he's 70 years old and he's about to die. And he thinks
71.
Oh, 71. Yeah.
71. Okay. I thought I read the article. I thought he said 71. And given that I'm 70, I pay attention to those sorts
right.
of things.
Right. Yeah. Well, there you go. But he's, so now he's contemplating the end of his life and contemplating the end of the bull run, the secular bull run that has been going on in stocks for the last few decades. make of that what you will. Anyway, so he's saying that it's all going to be giving up the ghost very soon. Anyway, I we're seeing a lot more of that type of talk from insiders recently, and I think that's just a reflection of the fact of what you said, that the QE, I don't think it even stopped the collapse that was happening in 2008. I think it just pressed the pause button. And you can't pause forever.
That's probably correct. At least it hasn't happened yet. You can give them credit for that. But they haven't, you know, there's a real question. One of the problems, so far as I can see, the Federal Reserve has two fundamental tactics for controlling the economy. And one is controlling the interest rates, and the other one is controlling the money supply. Now, the problem they've got is that once upon a time when this country, we had physical money, gold and silver, and we had two oceans that counted for something. If the Federal Reserve reduced the interest rate, the creditors couldn't do much about it other than just grin and just smile and go along with the program. All right? They had to take it or else just not loan their money. They had two choices, take it or leave it. But in the internet age, when they reduce the interest rate, I believe they are called, the creditors are just saying, well, I'm out of here. I'm moving my money to Africa or South America or Europe where I can get 5, 8, 10%. I'm not going to settle for getting. So my point is the reduction in interest rates now becomes counterproductive. It doesn't stimulate the economy. It actually drives money out of the economy, reduces the money supply, and will tend to slow the economy. I don't think they have a viable control on interest rates anymore. I think the only thing they have left is control of the money supply. And even that, I'm not sure that they've been successful. They injected, what, $3 trillion into the economy under the quantitative easing? And where is it? What's happened? Have we seen the effect of that yet? And it's part of the reason I'm wondering, does anyone have any real control? Is anybody in control anymore?
I think it's an important question because I think it does go to the heart of the issue that another layer of the house of cards that this economy is built on is that when you look at it, I mean, the Federal Reserve doesn't even have the direct ability to do very much. The federal funds rate isn't actually directly set by the Federal Reserve. It's targeted by the Federal Reserve. And how do they try to influence it towards that target? They try to use open market operations to influence the money supply. So they can basically send money into the economy by selling bonds. They can take it out by buying bonds back. But that's about all they can actually physically do. And everything else is just...
All we can do physically do right now is say thank you, James, for being on the program.
There you go.
Because we're out of time.
All right.
I look forward to talking to you again. Fascinating. We do live in interesting times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's... In any case, James Corbett from the Corbett Report, Corbett. You can find him on the internet. Take a look, CorbettReport.com. I'm Alfred Addis, and I want to thank all of you for listening. Be back tomorrow. In the meantime, with good Lord, bless you, me, Melody, Frank the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
I work all day.